Welcome to our show today. This is our first segment of our two-segment show, and we are going to be wrapping up and concluding the material that we have covered over these last several weeks. This was a lot of material, but we did try to reduce it into bite-sized pieces so that we could digest it. Because it's been such a long time since I started, we're going to go all the way back to the beginning, but this time, instead of taking the number of weeks we took, we're going to do it in a single broadcast. So let me go ahead and get started. First, the reason that this whole thing came into existence is because a question was asked. You have given a number of Protestant Christian commentaries that believe that the Torah is going to be in effect for believers in Yeshua until heaven and earth pass away. And the question was, can you bring to me a commentary in which they do not agree to that? I'd like to know what they say, and I'd like to know how they defend it. So we did. We went to the NICNT, which is the New International Commentary of the New Testament. And in that particular commentary, we pulled up the section, which is Matthew 5, 17 through 20. And the author broke down those things that he wanted to break down, bring to the attention of the audience to inform them about what Yeshua is saying. We covered that at the beginning, and as I said at that time, I was a tad disappointed that no big deal was made of the verb being in the active voice instead of the passive voice. And I felt like that was a significant, even serious oversight. But we've covered it before, so that's just, remember, this is a summary. So after we left verse 17, there was a discussion about doing away with the law, and one of the references was Galatians 5, so we went through that. Then, doing away with the food laws, there were two that he had for that, and one was Acts 11. We did that one. Romans 14, we did that one. And then he said that Matthew himself, if in fact he did have Yeshua saying that the Torah will be in effect for believers until the heavens and the earth pass away, he disagrees with himself and has Yeshua doing away with all the food laws in Matthew 15. And so I'm like, nope, that is not how it happened, and that's not what took place. So we had to review Acts 15, and in conjunction with doing that, we also looked at Mark 7, which is a parallel passage. We considered both of them because each one brings something to the table that the other does not, and so it makes the picture more complete, and we kind of put them together so that we would have a consistent presentation. So we went through all of that text, and we came to the conclusion that it does not look like Yeshua did away with the laws, the Old Testament food laws. So we're going to pick up the summary at that point. The first thing that I have to bring to your attention is something that we have reiterated along the way. I presented four questions, and you got to pick what you liked out of that. So I'm going to repeat that here so that it remains something that we're conscious of as we're going through the review material. As regards the Torah, which is the law of God, the primary purpose of the anointed one that was going to be sent was, one, to do away with the entire law. Two, to do away with some of the law, like maybe food laws, maybe the Sabbath, maybe the appointed times. Those are just suggestions. Do away with some of the laws. Three, we could follow what Deuteronomy 18 has to say about it, starting in verse 15 and 18, where the Most High says, I'm going to raise up a prophet like you, Moses, and I'm going to put my words in his mouth, and he's going to say them to everybody. That's a choice. And then four, you could choose that the primary mission of the Anointed One as regards the Torah, the law of God, was to unravel, untangle the oral tradition with the written law so that people could see both of them for what they are and move forward. And of course, we saw that he was doing some of that. All right, so that's the four questions. Just need to have them in our conscience as we're reviewing the material. Here's the review. Here we go. Concerning the food laws themselves, the point that I wanted to make was that it wasn't that long before the first century when there was a big issue about the food laws. And that took place, and we know that time period now as Hanukkah. That's a celebration of that time period. But the person who was in charge decided to force the Jews to eat pork, and there were some other things that were outside of Torah that were unlawful according to Torah that this gentleman did, Antiochus the Fourth. And so the Jews, they rejected. They rejected what he proposed. And there were several things that took place, including many Jews being murdered. Many of them had the option to eat the pork and live, and they chose not to. They made the stand. They would rather be put to death than to defile the covenant. And we have those quotes. It's in the book of Maccabees. We went through some of them. And so that was only, what would you say, maybe a couple hundred years before, plus or minus a few years here or there. So this is fresh in the people's minds, not only because it just happened, but it's also fresh in their minds because it's celebrated every year. It's not a required feast, but it was designated as a time in which we could remember the martyrs, those who did not reject being put to death for the sake of the Holy Covenant. With that in mind, we're coming to this story that is told in Matthew 15 and Mark 7, and many commentators have looked at this and said, well, you know, just in passing, he does away with the food laws, and nobody says a thing. Really? They died for this just a little while back, and now we're just going to get rid of them with the snap of the fingers, and nobody's even going to have a second thought about it. Questionable, questionable. Our first part of the review is the Maccabees and what took place there. The second part is what took place in the opening sections of Matthew 15 and Mark 7, is that what Deuteronomy records for us in chapter 18 is that I am going to raise up one like you, Moses, a prophet. So here's the question. What is the role of a prophet? If you look through the history of Israel, and we have hundreds of years of history of Israel, and we can look at what the prophets did, and consistently, the prophets went to the people, went to the leadership, and said, return to a more accurate observance of Torah, both in the ritual and in the heart. Depending on what the situation was, the message was crafted for those people at that time. So that's what a prophet does. Now, the prophecy in Deuteronomy 18 is that this anointed one who's coming is going to be a prophet like Moses. Now, let's ask this question. How was Moses involved with the Torah? How about he gave it to the people? He explained it to the people. He enforced it. He set up the entire framework and structure on how it was going to work for the nation of Israel. When the word says, I'm going to send one like Moses, a prophet, that's some heavy words. That's some big shoes to fill. So we'll have to look at his life, the things he said, and we did. And we've come to a conclusion about that. Next up in our review is actually the subject of the story, which has to do with ritual purity and impurity, and moral purity and impurity. It starts off dealing with issues of ritual impurity as it relates to the tradition of the elders. But Yeshua quickly took advantage of the opportunity to move it from ritual to moral. Reason? Because these things, sacrifices, priesthood, temple, tabernacle, appointed times, all of these things were types and pictures that pointed to a reality. The ritual purity system is no exception. So Yeshua took the opportunity to say, hey, all right, so you're doing some stuff that deals with ritual purity. You'll notice that in their finding fault, they didn't find fault with Yeshua. They found fault with some of the disciples who did not wash their hands. There is an explanation about why that doesn't take place, and Yeshua goes through that. We went through it in a lot of detail, got into the weeds a little bit with the Mishnah, but I wanted to just give a summary statement that kind of ties it all together. That entire teaching has nothing to do with now making all food that was unclean clean. In other words, the other white meat, pork, now it's food. No, that teaching had nothing to do with that. Rather, this teaching involved instruction about eating bread with unwashed hands, and that does not bring contaminants into us that affect or diminish our spiritual sanctity or holiness. That is the emphasis of that teaching. So we dealt with the word common, we dealt with defilement, we looked at some different passages. So that is the summary there, that he wanted to make clear that the fact that they think there is a derived impurity because they walk through town and they need to wash their hands is not true. It's a rabbinic fiction. Also, the extension of the priest requirements to be ritually pure, to consume the sacrifices the people bring to the temple, that's true. But to extend that to the people, that is false. That is a heavy yoke. This is something that we rejected. Yeshuic Judaism rejects. And the disciples didn't, some of the disciples didn't do it. We don't know how many were there. We don't know how many didn't have their hands washed. But some did, and that precipitated this entire teaching. Next up on the list is the way that the literary structure of the story took place. Going to not the chapter and verse 1, but the previous chapter of each book and the last verse of that was telling the same story about Yeshua being in a position to heal people who came out to him, and that many of them grabbed upon his tzitzit. So the reference was made to the tzitzit. Now, what is the tzitzit about? That's very clear. That's very easy. It was given in Numbers. The reason it was given is so that you could look down and see it and you would remember to do all of the commandments. That's why it was there. The text in Numbers is very clear and very specific. You look down, you see them, you are reminded to do all of the commandments. And the next verse in our story is the beginning of this interaction with a subset of the Pharisees, some scribes that came down from Jerusalem to get into this discussion. Moving on after that, I wanted to look at some other evidences, I'm going to use that word, that support what I am trying to understand took place in this teaching. It is my position that the text in its literary form does not support that Yeshua overturned and did away with all of the food laws that are found in Torah. He did not do away with everything that relates to ritual purity and impurity. That's not what the discussion was about. It was about correcting a tradition and addressing the need for a balance. Moral purity is more important than the ritual purity that points to it, but it's still a type, it's a picture, and we can learn from that in any century. So I want to pick up this discussion later on in Matthew 23. What we have is Yeshua is talking to the Pharisees, and honestly, he's kind of like getting on their case in a serious manner. I'm not going to go through that whole thing in chapter 23, but there is a short section I'd like to deal with. It's only four verses. It's chapter 23, verses 25 through 28. In answer to those who say that at the time Yeshua had this meal with the Pharisees and scribes that came down from Jerusalem, and at that point he said that the ritual purity laws have all been done away with, listen to what Matthew 23, verses 25 through 28 have to say. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. He used the hypocrite word also in Matthew 15 and Mark 7. You clean the outside of the cup and dish. That sounds like an actual washing thing. But inside, they are full of greed and self-indulgence. So now he's moved from a cup to inside a person. Blind Pharisee, that comes from Isaiah 29, which was quoted by Yeshua, and it's also mentioned in the Matthew version. First clean the inside of the cup and dish. Is he talking about actually cleaning the cup or the dish, or is he talking about inside? Because then he says, and then the outside also will be clean. So that can't have to do with actual reality washing. That has to do with internal. If you clean up the inside of a person, then the outside will be clean because what comes out of their heart will be clean. 27, woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. So it appears to me that at this point, Yeshua is stating that there are things that are still unclean. 28, in the same way, on the outside, you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside, you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. Seems like the same message that we were hearing from Matthew 15 and Mark 7, but here it is a little bit more expanded, more detail, and that was just a sampling. Next up in our discussion, I want to move to Acts 10. This is where we have Peter, and he is on the roof, and he's hungry. He gets a vision. We've covered some of that. In detail, we covered Acts 11. So here is the question that I want to bring to you. Peter was a disciple of Yeshua. Even in the story, the Mark 15 story, Mark 7, that story in parallel, one of the Gospels makes note of the fact that Peter is there. Yeshua makes his initial statement concerning the Pharisees. Then he draws the crowd in because they have misunderstood him. So he explains it again. Then Peter comes and says, could you explain this to us again? And so the disciples are going to now hear exactly what it is that Yeshua means by the things that he said previously. So whatever he said, he said. We have a little bit of it in the text. Now, Acts 10. This is well after the resurrection and the ascension. So this is after that event. Peter, as a disciple, he's not only a disciple of the 12, but he is of the inner circle. Think back to the transfiguration as one example. Who is the voice of the leadership of Yeshua Judaism in Acts 2? Peter. He's the one that preaches the sermon. He's the one that quotes the prophets about what has happened and is going to happen. Then as we continue in Acts, he's the one that directly interfaces with the leadership, the Iudaioi, of the Jews. And then he's the first one to be sent to the Gentiles to let them know that a way has been made for them to come in to the commonwealth of Israel without having to go through the proselyte ceremony. Now, having said that, let's drill down in Acts 10. There's a sheet that's dropped down out of heaven. A voice from heaven speaks. And what does Peter say? Peter is in a state of shock. Now, how's that possible? If he had been taught that it was acceptable to eat those things that were unclean, maybe they've become food now as well, he would not have been shocked at all. But instead, the story presents that he is incredibly shocked, and he has a response which deals with common and unclean, those two Greek words. The way the story is presented by Luke, it presupposes that Peter is not aware of a previous ruling by Yeshua that the food laws have been done away with or changed. It indicates that he's never received such a teaching or example from Yeshua over the period that he was with him. If Yeshua had terminated that aspect of Torah, it is reasonable to assume Peter would have known about it. And the fact that he was shocked would betray that this is brand new information. And if we go back to Peter going to Yeshua to the end of the Mark 7 account and the Matthew 15 account, Peter is going to Yeshua and saying, please explain this to us. If Yeshua said, well, what I did was I did away with all the Old Testament clean and unclean and ritual purity, the surprise and shock of Peter in Acts 10 reveals that that is not what Yeshua instructed the disciples or Peter. So I believe this gives us a reasonable place to be able to see history unfold the evidence. So what we're going to do, we're going to end this segment, and we're going to pick it up here on the other side of the half hour. Thank you. Welcome back to this half hour. We're picking it up on the other side, and we're going to continue with our summary. And boy, do we have a lot of stuff to go through, but we're just going to get to it. I do want to let you know that even though I'm only touching on some of the items that are being handled here, the important thing is that we've already covered a lot of it, and for some of these additional pieces, in the next couple of months, we're going to break it down. We're going to spend more time with them so that you have a clear picture. For example, over the next 2 months, we're going to go to P. Oxy 840 and look at more than just a couple of the quotes. We've got to break down the Netzarim sects, Isaiah commentaries that were written in the late 2nd and early 3rd century. Definitely have to look a little bit more at the Polycarp, Anicetus, Victor, Polycrates, end of the 2nd century. Very important text there. I'll be reading some of the quote, but we really do have to talk about it. Then, of course, the Dedicae is going to have to be looked at in more detail than just the quotes that I'm going to give you today. And then in October, we're going to pick up the Bar Kokhba revolt. We'll have to look at that in detail, although today I'm just going to mention some pieces. We'll talk about canon on the 8th, because that's what I'll be talking about at the Feast of Tabernacles on that day. The 15th, we're going to go back to Epiphanius, Jerome, Eusebius, and others who talk about the Netzarim over the first 5 centuries. Then later in that month, we'll pick up Justin Martyr. And then finally, at the end of October, we'll start looking at specific books that address these things. So a lot to do, a lot to cover, and it's quite informative. Some of it perhaps may even be surprising. But anyway, we just finished with Peter in Acts 10, so let's go right now over to Acts 15. This is Jerusalem Council. As you know, it was understood halakha of the first century of the Pharisees that if you were going to inherit life in the Olam Rahaba, then you had to convert to being a Jew, because that's all they understood. But the problem was is that that conversion, that proselyte ceremony, had been done away with. That is made clear by Paul in the book of Galatians. They were concerned in this meeting, and the halakha is going to be set up by Yaakov or James for us KJV people. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the two verses that really speak to this, because remember, this is evidence that's addressing what the NICNT addresses as far as Mark 7 and Matthew 15 and the food laws and ritual purity. The conclusion is that those were done away with, and we're going to look at some pieces of evidence that disagree with that conclusion. So here we go, Acts 15, 20 and 21. But that we should write them a letter telling them to abstain from things defiled by idols, from sexual immorality, from what has been strangled, and from blood. 21. For Moses has those who proclaim him in every town, and this has been taking place from ancient times. He is read aloud in the synagogues every Sabbath. The second word, if you look at the Greek of 21, is the word gar, which is the word for, therefore, I can say this stuff in the past, I am saying, this is my conclusion, this is why I can do it, because Moses proclaimed. All of these believers will be heading to the synagogue. They will be able to hear Moses. They'll learn and understand. But here's what's interesting. In the letter part, things defiled by idols, strangled, blood. That all falls under unclean, clean, ritual, purity, impurity. So what would happen here is that if Yeshua did away with it in Mark 7, Matthew 15, then it was re-put in here. And the Holy Spirit agrees. So that's a problem. All right, let's continue. We're going to move now to Paul. Paul has been collecting some money for the assemblies in Jerusalem. He's returned. We're going to pick up Acts 21, verse 17. When we arrived in Jerusalem, the brothers welcomed us gladly. The next day, Paul went in to see Yaakov, and all the elders were there. When Paul had greeted them, he began to explain in detail what God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. When they heard this, they praised God. Then they said to him, this is what most of the English translations have, and it is incorrect, and I will fix that. It says, you see, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are who have believed, and they are all zealous for observance of Torah. That's incorrect. Here's the correct reading. Then they said to him, you see, brother, how many tens of thousands of Jews there are who have believed, and they are all zealous for observance of the Torah. There is a difference between thousands and tens of thousands, especially when you start looking at the research that's been done of the number of Jews that were residents in Jerusalem at that time, research that I've already done. So there is a big difference between thousands and tens of thousands. So let's move on. The next passage that's of interest to us is the status of Paul. We could call it the state of Paul. It's in chapter 23 and verse 6. Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, "My brothers, I am a Pharisee, descended from Pharisees." So here we are after year 60. So maybe Paul's been working on this for 20, 25 years. We don't know exactly for sure. At least I don't remember seeing a text that says so. But at this point here, toward the end of his life in the 60s, he is saying, "I am a Pharisee." That's present tense. That's not, "I used to be a Pharisee and now I'm a Christian." It doesn't say the Pharisees, Sadducees called out, "I am a Christian." It doesn't say that. It says, "I am a Pharisee." So that tells us his position, his understanding, and it's going to be expanding more. You're sitting there going, "Well, how does it relate to ritual purity and the Torah?" Fasten your seatbelt. Here we go. 24:5. The attorney representing the high priest says, "We found this man to be a troublemaker," talking about Paul, "one who stirs up riots." Yeah, he does, because he is voiding the halakha that has been established by the Pharisees, and they're going with Yeshua's halakha. So yeah, it stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world, and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. So you got the sect of the Pharisees, you've got the sect of the Zealots, you've got the sect of the Sadducees, and here you have the sect of the Nazarenes. He doesn't object to that, because just a few verses later, he says, "I confess to you that I worship the God of our ancestors according to the way," which they call a sect. And remember, sect means you think about things differently. So that's true. So he is still worshiping God, but he's interpreting the text differently. And who might be the one who's the authorized interpreter? Yeshua. "Believing everything that is according to the law and that is written in the prophets." Acts 25:8, Paul said in his defense, "I have committed no offense against the 1, Jewish law, 2, the temple, 3, Caesar." Interesting. Continuing, 25:13-19. Starting at 13, after several days had passed, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived in Caesarea to pay their respects to Festus. While they were staying there many days, Festus explained Paul's case to the king to get his opinion, saying, "There's a man left here as a prisoner by Felix. When I was in Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me about him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. I answered them that it's not the custom of the Romans to hand over anyone before the accused had met his accusers face to face." Thank goodness for that level of justice. "And had been given an opportunity to make a defense against the accusation. So after they came back here with me, I did not postpone the case, but the next day I sat on the judgment seat and ordered the man to be brought." Now this is the important part. 18, "When his accuser stood up, they did not charge him with any of the evil deeds I had suspected. Rather, they had several points of disagreement with him about their own religion." See what I'm saying? They disagreed because he was changing the halakha according to the directions of Yeshua. So they had several points of disagreement about their own way to do Judaism. And the second thing, about a man named Yeshua who was dead, but Paul claimed that he was alive. So there was a disagreement on a point of fact. Was Yeshua alive? Was Yeshua dead? Then they disagreed. All right, let's continue. Acts 26:1-8. Here we go, another trial. "So Agrippa said to Paul, 'You have permission to speak for yourself.' Then Paul held out his hand and began his defense. 'Regarding all the things I have been accused of by the Jews, King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate that I am about to make my defense before you today, because you are especially familiar with all the customs and controversial issues of the Jews." See, that's good. "Therefore, I ask you to listen to me patiently. Now, all the Jews know the way I lived from my youth, spending my life from the beginning among my own people and in Jerusalem. They know because they have known me from time past. And if they were willing to testify that according to the strictest party of our religion, I lived as a Pharisee. And now I stand here on trial because of my hope in the promise made by God to our ancestors, a promise that our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly serve God day and night. Concerning this hope, the Jews are accusing me, Your Majesty. Why do you people think it's unbelievable that God raises the dead? Interesting. Continuing in that chapter, we're moving to verse 22. I have experienced help from God to this day, and so I stand testifying to both small and great, saying nothing except what the prophets and Moses said was going to happen. Remember, late 60s, he's heading down the path to death. This is not early, this is late. This is the end of his life. And he is saying that he's not saying anything except what the prophets and Moses said was going to happen. Remember, a few verses earlier, there is a difference in interpretation. They agree on the Torah, they agree on the prophets, but they are interpreting differently what they mean. Here is an example in 26:22. Now let's go over to the last chapter of Acts, chapter 28. Starting in 17, after 3 days, Paul called the local Jewish leaders, not the local Christian leaders, called the local Jewish leaders together. When they had assembled, he said to them, "Brothers, although I had done nothing against our people or the customs of our ancestors, from Jerusalem I was handed over as a prisoner to the Romans. When they heard my case, they wanted to release me, because there was no basis for a death sentence against me. But when the Jews objected, I was forced to appeal to Caesar, not that I had some charge to bring against my own people." 20. "So for this reason, I have asked to see you and speak with you, for I am bound with this chain because of the hope of the Christians." Nope. "Because of the hope of Israel." And they replied, "We have received no letters from Judea about you, nor have any of the brothers come from there and reported or said anything bad about you." 22. "But we would like to hear from you what you think, for regarding this sect," that's the sect of the Nazarenes that Paul is a ringleader of, "for regarding this sect, we know that people everywhere speak against it." In other words, the Jews speak against it because the rabbis are not changing the halakha. Paul is changing the halakha. This other set of Jews and the Gentiles associated with them, worshiping in the synagogue, are following a new halakha which disagrees with Pharisaic halakha. And so, yes, they're going to speak evil against it. And that's what it says there. So these are just some of the verses that talk about the role of Paul in representing the prophets and the Torah. Now, this doesn't specifically speak to clean and unclean. However, they are contained within Torah, and there's no mention of that change in any of this here. Now, but we will get straight into that because I'm coming over to Revelation 2, 12. This is the angels in the ecclesia. This is Pergamum. And it says, "This is the solemn pronouncement of the one who has a sharp double-edged sword. I know where you live, where Satan's throne is. Yet you cling to my name and you have not denied your faith. But I have a few things against you. You have some people there who follow the teaching of Balaam, who instructed Balak to put a stumbling block before the people of Israel so they would eat food sacrificed to idols and commit sexual immorality. In the same way, there are also some among you who follow the teaching of the Nicolaitans." So here we're talking about food sacrificed to idols. Apparently that's still in place. Let's continue on. That's toward the end of the first century. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to pick up the Dedicae, and the point that we're going to talk about, and I'm quoting a document. This is from Novum Testamentum, and it was written in October of 1991. It's called "Torah and Troublesome Apostles in the Dedicae Community." There's a word that is used in Matthew 5:48 in the Greek. It's telos, which is perfect and complete. Like if you have a lamp, it's got a light bulb and electric wire, and you plug it into electricity, like an electric socket in a wall, and you flip the switch and the light comes on, that lamp is perfect. It's complete. It does what it's supposed to do. So in the Dedicate, there's a discussion. I'm picking it up on page 367 of this Journal Review, it says, the perfect or complete Christian and dedicated then is the one who keeps the whole Torah, according to Christian Halakha. How about that? The food laws were the minimum legal requirement to ensure table fellowship between the perfect and the uncircumcised Gentiles. The community of the dedicate remains within the parameters of faithful Torah observant Yeshuic Judaism, but takes an understanding line on the problems of Gentile believers who are not excluded from the community, just relegated to the status of second class. On the other hand, the dedicate takes a harsh line with those who oppose this instruction. Anyone who teaches differently is teaching contrary to God himself. Dedicate 6:1 is connected to 6:2 by G.A.R. We just talked about that in Acts 15:21, indicating a connection. This teaching on the Torah was an inseparable part of what was taught to all converts before their baptism. So as you can see, there is really a lot here that deals with Torah within the Dedicate. So now we're going to move on to page 369. It says, the threat to the community does not come from outside, but from within, from false prophets and corruptors, from sheep who have turned into wolves. Those who were once seemingly faithful members have turned against the community. In Dedicate love, which once existed between the false apostles, prophets, and the community, is turned into hatred. We're on 370 now. The reason is again given in what follows. The disastrous betrayal by former members is caused by an increase in anomia. That's the Greek word, lawlessness. Same exact Greek word that is found in Matthew 7, when Yeshua says, depart from me, because you are anomia. It refers here to those who put aside the Torah and advocate lessening and removing those instructions. So here we are seeing that the community is still following Torah, and there were some people who were members of the community. Then they change from sheep into wolves and are attacking the community, and the Dedicate is there to sort that out, mark them, so that they are not allowed to come into the community and share false doctrine that is against God. That's the Dedicate. That's pretty good. All right, let's continue on. We've got Bar Kokhba. And what happened there was is that Rabbi Akiva selected him as the Messiah. Those believers who were in the synagogue community were not able to join in, and so they had to step away. The Jews, and this was the plan, that was committing treason because it was a required war. Therefore, they had no choice but to leave, and many tens of thousands of believers were murdered. Moving from there into Polycarp and Polycrates. Once again, Polycarp was dealing with the time of the 15 bishops. Then he goes to Rome in 150 to meet with Anicetus, because now the Gentiles have stopped observing Passover in the correct date. They've already started making changes to the law. So he goes to correct it, but Anicetus is not going to be persuaded because he feels like he has to follow the tradition that was established by a few bishops in the past. So they break on good terms. Then a few years later, Victor brings up the same thing with Polycrates. But what Polycrates does is he pulls together all of the followers and writes a letter back, and he says it's very simple. We scrupulously observe the exact day, neither adding nor taking away. Many of the believers have already passed away. He uses the term fallen asleep, and he lists them. And after listing this list, he says all these observe the 14th day of the month in accordance with the gospel, deviating in no respect but following the rule of faith. Seven of my relatives were bishop. I'm the eighth. My relatives always observe the day the people put away the leaven. And in case there's any question about what that day is, I've met with the brethren throughout the world, gone through every holy scripture. Could mention the bishops. There's a large number of them. And they gave their unanimous consent to the letter. Rome, you will not have any authority over us in taking away the law of Moses. Wow, that's pretty cool. All right, let's move on. Remember, this is just a review. We're now going to Pioxy 840. We're on page 176. It's talking about Mark 7 because this is part of the ritual purity issue. So here's what it says in B. Both texts emphasize the vivid contrast between internal and external cleanliness. Mark says, nothing outside of man can make him unclean by going into him. Rather, it is what comes out of a man that makes him unclean. And in Mark 7:23, all these evil things proceed from within and defile the man. In other words, Yeshua is declaring that these external rites are limited in their ability to make a person clean. The real cleaning must be done internally. Well, P. Oxy 840 does the same thing. It contrasts a declaration about the outside. You have wiped the outer with a declaration about the inside, but the inside of them. So we're still talking about ritual purity in the middle of the second century. These people don't know it was done away back then. In both texts, Yeshua refuses to participate in man-made traditions that are not consistent with the Torah. And you've read the text. So here we are once again. It's in place. So now let's take a look quickly at the history. There was definitely an understanding that we're still supposed to be following this. In the Dedicé at 6, it says, as regards food, what thou art able, bear. And it points back to the Jerusalem Council. Then if you look at 177, the martyrs of lions ate kosher food bought at a Jewish meat market. Christians of Africa in the late 2nd century took seriously the decree, and requirements were viewed as law in the Church of the East. And this just keeps going on. So what we end up with is that we have a lot of people who are observing it, including the ritual purity and unclean clean that supposedly was done away with. Let's go quickly over to Jerome's letter 75 to Augustine. This is the end of the 4th century. They did not call themselves Christians, but Nazarenes. They accepted Yeshua as the Messiah with Torah observant. They used the Tanakh in Hebrew, Matthew in Hebrew. They accepted Jewish tradition, but not the rabbinic halakha. Clearly, the Nazarenes, slightly different there. Now, one of the things that I do want to point out, that was in the end of the 4th century, but there's also in the prophets, Ezekiel, talking about the millennial temple, referred to in Revelation, also Zechariah 14. But here's the spot that I want to go to, because remember, we're looking at verses that are relating to the ritual, purity, impurity, the clean, unclean. And so in Ezekiel 44:23, talking about the service of the temple during the millennial kingdom, says, they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the common, and show them how to distinguish between unclean and the clean. They shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the common, and show them how to distinguish between the unclean and the clean. Isn't it interesting? It appears that almost 2,000 years, and then the millennial kingdom starts, and that which was done away with in Mark 7 and Matthew 15 has been brought back. So it was brought back for Peter. It was brought back for James. It was brought back for Paul. It was brought back at the revelation, the angels in Pergamum. Then all the believers, Christians and Jews in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century still thought it applied. And now here we are in the millennial kingdom, and it's still in place. All of this evidence presents the case that the interpretation of Mark 7 and Matthew 15 has nothing to do with doing away with the ritual purity laws and clean and unclean. And our evidence seems to make a case. This does deal with oral tradition that has gone too far. That's the end of my summary. Thank you so much.